Welcome back to Part Fried History. Today we are doing the second part or fifth part in our six-part installment on the French Revolution and Napoleonic era. This is part two of Napoleon.
That's the most complicated.
How are you guys doing? Yeah.
That's the most complicated version of what.
you gotta be on point with the metrics, you know. You gotta date everything nowadays. That's the way to do it. It is 8:59 and some change here on and now it's 9 o'clock, just turned 9 o'clock. So I had a lot of change apparently. June 10th, 2022. Houston, Texas, right? I guess they have all the data points already. Who cares? That is,
okay.
Here we go. All right. Okay. We're going to jump right in with Act One, Part Two, Act One, Catching His Breath. January of 1800, France is facing a lot of war weariness in regard to the Italian campaign. Talleyrand is sending out peace feelers to England. They are rejected. The big problem for the governing body of France right now at the time is they need a victory because the people are getting restless again and they want to hang on to power, but they have to let off some steam. The major problems that they have currently are three primarily. The war in the Vendée is still going on. The government is facing bankruptcy and the second coalition is at their heels. And so war is basically going to break out in any second. So throughout 1800, the way I see it is Napoleon's just kind of like cleaning up in northern Italy. He's got his great victory at Marengo in June. Another French general named Moreau has his victory at Hohenlinden, which I think is in like southern Germany, in December. Again, like I'm saying, they were cleaning up against the Austrians primarily.
And they're all like getting all the generals are getting all this praise and all this type of stuff, and they're becoming like these dramatic heroes in all of France. They already were, but they're becoming more of those.
Yeah, especially because the old aristocracy is dead and kind of like the old, I don't want to say like the celebrity class, but the generals are definitely asserting themselves as the new aristocracy.
Of course.
And there's even like inter-beefs. I think one of the big points about like Moreau's victory was that although it was good for France generally, Napoleon was upset that he wasn't the guy who got the victory. He was like, "You're stealing my limelight, man. I'm the big dog general. I'm the one who does all the big important battles. I'm the one who wins them. If Moreau is, he thinks he can do it. Not we're gonna have problems. We are going to have problems."
Yeah, they're all going out and like exploring, or I don't know what it's called. They're like winning stuff for France.
Yeah,
and the French Republic, and then it's there's a part of, I think, Moreau involved with Ireland. There's a lot of different stories. Yeah.
But it's a lot going on. Yeah. That's like the hardest thing about Napoleon is that I'm doing the best I can just to get the dates and the locations correctly. But there's a lot of intricacies that I'm not able to hit.
Yeah.
December 24th of 1800, there is an assassination attempt on his carriage on his way to the Paris Opera. It is a royalist plot that he blamed on the Jacobins.
Yeah, that's the one where like it's like a girl. This dude gives this girl the reins to hold, and in somewhere outside of Paris, a Parisian suburb or in Paris, and then he fucking the carriage is like, there's like a explosion. It's like an IUD. The weird terrorist attack. It's a terrorist attack in the 1800s.
Wait, and then IUD?
IUD, not IUD. IED. Yeah, okay. There we go. It's one of those. Well, anyway.
And a feminist suicide bombing going on.
Well, I mean, he does kill like a 16-year-old girl. So it is kind of like that's who he gives the range to. And he like, it's a massive explosion. And then he just decides. He like, from my understanding, he takes both of them out of the way. Like he blames the world, but it also is an excuse to get rid of the Jacobins and kind of clear his way for power.
Yeah, it's kind of you see that repetition of what like D'Eglantine and Danton and Desmoulins are trying to pop off toward the end of that sort of like linking the far right to the far left, being like, you guys are the problem, using that as just a way to crack down on fringe parties.
Yeah, and kind of make him, you know, they seem like more the guy.
You know what they say, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. When life tries to kill you, kill other people.
Okay. I don't know if they say that.
That's the way I've always heard.
And don't know if anybody.
Classic parallelism. Okay.
That's fine.
February of 1801, Austrians signed the Treaty of Lunéville, which basically takes them out of the fight for now. Just Great Britain to worry about, really. Napoleon, he's trying to angle for an alliance with Tsar Paul of Russia to march into India, because he know that with that, you know, India at this time is, I don't want to say it's the jewel in the crown quite yet. It's being refined into the jewel in the crown, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so they think that if they start marching toward India or exert any sort of pressure on India, that that's going to massively stabilize Great Britain. And Tsar Paul is considering it, and so is the French government, until Tsar Paul is assassinated by, there's like this internal cabal that emerges against Tsar Paul, but there was also, I think one of the books said that he was being, that cabal was being paid by British agents. So I don't know what their beef was with, or the Russia, Great Britain fallout, why they would want to kill Tsar Paul, but it happens.
Yeah.
There's a separate treaty that happens. I don't have the name. Spain signs over 6 warships and the Louisiana Territory to Napoleon. And a lot of European nations are closing their ports to British trade in order to ice them out, what we would call like sanctions nowadays. That's the modern equivalency. I don't know when the term comes into vogue, but we just call it a blockade then, I guess.
Yeah.
And then throughout the 1790s, we didn't mention in the last episode, but I want to bring it up here because it is relevant. You have Toussaint Louverture's rebellion in the 1790s in Haiti. Napoleon at first like cultivates him, since he was called the Black Napoleon, Toussaint Louverture was, but eventually they have a falling out. Toussaint stops taking Napoleon's advice. Great Britain and France clash on Haiti in 1801. The French forces are at 25,000 when they land in that year, but yellow fever epidemics basically cleave through their ranks, leave them with around 3,000 by the time they surrendered to the British in 1803. And that, I think that effectively ends French rule in Haiti in 1803, because they just kind of wash their hands of it.
I mean, the Haitian Revolution, like going throughout the 1790s, at first it like being like a complete like slave rebellion, mm-hmm. and then it like linking up with like kind of this Creole kind of class, which is Toussaint is a part of, it's a interesting and a long history, and mm-hmm. like we don't have time to do it. Yeah. But I just, whenever people bring up Toussaint, I always go like, the Haitian people. Because there's like a big divide between like the actual like enslaved, like Black African population and the like Creole port city Toussaint, like Black Napoleon, kind of Black Jacobin type of stuff, where they're like kind of, they always praise them, but they never talk about bookmen and like the actual people who like, you know, but that's a whole different thing. But yeah, we don't have like
proletariat, bourgeois, liberal divide.
Yeah.
Or it's like, we have to work together to overthrow the oppressor, but let's not pretend there's not still internal class divisions.
Yeah. Then they try to put, after the thing, they try to reconstitute the kind of like plantation society. And it's, well, in like a lesser terms with like, without the, you know, with like Black people in charge. And then they don't, the African people don't want, it's a lot. Yeah. And like, that's, so I, whenever we bring up the Haitian Revolution, just glance at it, but let's move. It's a big deal during this time. Yeah. It's a big deal in France, like, you know, but it is their crown jewel per se.
Especially because, as rhetorically, they're taking a lot of the same pages out of the books that the French themselves were. Of like, oh, liberté, égalité, fraternité, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Us too, right? We're getting in on this, and it's like, yeah. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, no. Then again, when it evolves into like a weird, like people get free and they're like, "All right, what's freedom?" It's like, well, we can do the plantation state again, or we can have like maybe like a, there's like an early like commune style. Like, it's a whole lot of stuff. But let's move. Yeah, move on.
July of 1801, there's the Treaty of Concordat with Pope Pius the VII. This is kind of the major olive branch that the French government, after all of the turbulence of the 1790s and like the stain of de-Christianization of the 1793 onward and like the sale of church lands and whatnot, of things had been not good, very cool to say the least, between the papacy and the French government. And so Napoleon kind of does concordat as a way to appease the Catholics within France, but also some like of the royalists. He basically trying to put some oil on troubled waters, heal and make sure everyone's cool, right? Just kind of consolidate power by closing as many fronts, potential fronts, even if there be socio-political fronts, as possible.
It's if you go back to the gardening aspect of this, it is there's a thing called grafting where you've taken a, where you're taking a, the way it was described in that Scar book with Napoleon, A Life in Gardens, it was like described as if bringing religion back into France is seen as a way to like, it's a way to implement or graft a part of another tree onto another tree, a way to like create a firm backbone bone in society that used to be there.
Yeah.
You know, and there was chaos, you know, happening at the time, and Napoleon as a gardener or whatever, he comes in and is like, all right, I'm going to use this kind of firm, graft is the all right word to describe it, another part of a tree to kind of
uphold yeah. the one that needs help.
Yeah, yeah, and creating a new tree that has new dimensions to it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's he brings back in religion to a society that like kind of was that it had its own religion. I would argue
kind of never lost it. Let's be real. Like people were still practicing, but this is like an official recognition that matters, I think, more at the upper crust than at the rural levels. But public opinion matters.
But it does bring back,
not downplay, you know,
structurally a part of society that was there, but it reinvigorates it.
Yeah.
It makes it like another, like brings back that pillar of society, yes, I guess.
You can have like your religious festivals publicly and not worried about like some Jacobin being like, you're stupid or whatever, you know?
I mean, that's still going to happen, but
that's still gonna happen. But they can't kill you for it anymore, which I guess is progress. Yeah. Goes without saying it recognized Catholicism as the religion of France. The first consulate, that being Napoleon, he could name bishops to be confirmed and ratified by the Pope. The French government and the Holy See would work together on the establishment of new dioceses. Upon an oath to the French government, bishops would then receive state salaries, which is nice, and church lands taken from the revolution. That's like the bad thing for the papacy, is that all those church lands that were auctioned off by the revolutionary government, they're not going to be restored. Whoever bought them, it's going to stay in their hands.
Yeah.
And maybe Napoleon probably got some kickbacks for making sure that was not
messed up. This the money transfer has already been done.
Yeah,
You're going to retransfer the money?
No, man.
Yeah, no, you're not going to do that. So
not against these landed estates, these huge landed estates.
You give anybody things, like that's why people like don't want to give you give anybody some stuff. It's very hard to take the stuff back then.
Yeah. No takesies backsies, man.
Yep.
We learned this young, okay? April 26th of 1802, the amnesty law for emigres are passed as long as they did not bear arms against the nation. About 40,000 emigres who fled during the revolution returned home in I'm not sure in that year. I think like starting that year, that's the figure that was given. At least same year, 1802, the price of bread starts to increase. Never good. Napoleon orders a newspaper blackout on the issue, so nobody's allowed to report on rising bread prices. He gives concessions to a financial holding company to buy all the bread at European ports and flood the nation with it in order to stabilize its price and make sure, more to the point, that people are eating. Yeah. And then provide interest-free loans to various types of manufacturers so long as they took on new employees in order to take care of the unemployed. Because here he is learning directly from the lessons of the revolution, which is that if people are starving and unemployed, it does not bode well for your regime. So take care of hunger and take care of employment and you won't be deposed.
Yeah.
And then you just have to worry about your external enemies as opposed to your internal ones, you know?
Of course.
August of 1802, there's a plebiscite naming Napoleon consul for life, and it is ratified. He now had more control over foreign policy. I think they still have the consulate, so it's him and like two other dudes, but he's the only one who's consul for life. So yeah, we're gradually moving towards him just being the one guy.
Yeah.
The same year, 1802, the Napoleonic codes are promulgated. They are very in-depth. They deserve just as much coverage as the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizens, which we also didn't really go that deep into. Napoleonic codes, they protect the right of property, obviously, because you're not shaking up the bag again. You're looking to settle things down. Not too much for the proletariat generally. It does crack down on unions and pretty severely restricts women's rights, particularly to divorce and mortgage, trade, or sell property, which these were all rights acquired by women under the revolutionary government in September 1792. Yeah. Napoleon basically rescinds that. February of 1803, there are discussions between Napoleon and Ambassador Whitworth of Great Britain, because Britain at this time is hostile to the Treaty of Amiens, which I believe was like a ceasefire between France and Britain. Britain themselves, they justified staying in Alexandria and Malta, which were conditioned. The conditions of the treaty was that Britain would have to withdraw from Alexandria and Egypt and Malta, this small little island off the coast of southern Italy, like right in the middle of the Mediterranean. Britain would have to withdraw from those two, but they say we stayed there only because you annexed Piedmont, which is like northwestern Italy, what we think of now. And Napoleon also imposed a new constitution in Switzerland. You also occupied those two areas, as well as Holland and Genoa.
Yeah.
And so then Napoleon, he points out that the Treaty of Amiens, it made no mention of Piedmont or Switzerland. And as well as stipulation of Amiens, the British had not returned Pondicherry to the French. Pondicherry being the main, I think it's the main French colonial base in India, and Britain had occupied it and not returned it, even though they were supposed to. So there's bad faith, I want to say, most definitely on the side of the British. I don't know enough about it to know if the French were double dealing at all, but it definitely, the way it was framed was that Britain's just kind of saying they're pushing their luck here, and they can afford to, so why not, you know?
Yeah.
April 30th of 1803, this is the conclusion of the Louisiana Purchase negotiations. The French wanted 80 million francs for the land, but only got 60 million francs after negotiations. That, I think, you know, the grade school figure is always $15 million. Now, the U.S. public, the reason that 20,000 francs were knocked off that price, because the U.S. public amounted French damages to U.S. shipping to 20 million francs. So they knocked that off the price. And again, he wants to pay for the war that he's pretty sure Napoleon has to pay for the war that he's pretty sure that he's about to fight, and he needs the money. But also, obviously, a momentous decision in world history generally, because it, by giving such a large land concession to the U.S., mm-hmm. he almost guarantees that in time it would be a world power if it could figure out its own stuff and sets manifest destiny in motion and all this stuff.
It's to him, it's an auxiliary piece of land that he doesn't really control that much. Yeah. And like, it was good mainly because, you know, it was like an accessory to Haiti, from my understanding. Like, it was integral in all of their holding. Yeah. If they don't have Haiti, it's kind of like pointless. And they're like, fuck it.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So,
it's almost like transfer to him more as like a bargaining chip than a legit prospect.
Yeah.
So he's like, well, let me just flip this, you know?
All they have is New Orleans there. And then other than that, like, they're like,
we haven't really developed it.
It's just trade that comes through, but like, they're like, all right.
Yeah. I got bigger concerns, man. You know, This gets us into Act Two, Winds of Change. In May of 1803, Great Britain and France are officially at war, Great Britain being the instigator. They're worried about Napoleon's growing power, so they preemptively sought to go to war with him in order to curb this threat. And Napoleon's navy is not ready. He's got 39 ships of the line and 35 frigates, while Great Britain had 202 and 277, respectively. So, yeah. major naval advantage, Great Britain. But yeah. Will that matter if you can get control of the continent? Can he get control of the continent? We'll find out, right? March 21st of 1804, the Duke d'Enghien, or Duke d'Enghien Louis de Bourbon-Conte, is killed after a trial. He's like apprehended. He's like, I'm not sure what the precise details are. I meant to go over it. He's apprehended. He's given the very quick, I think, relatively ham-fisted trial and implicated in this royalist plot of which the Duke d'Enghien knew nothing. However, the other French generals, Pichegru and Moreau, were both implicated.
Yeah.
And he kills this kid. And then he's like a kid. I think he's like a teenager at the time of his death. Or he's like very young. And that's the big issue is it's like, oh, you're killing kids now. And so this is like a huge stain on his reputation, but also it was framed that he was kind of like virtue signaling to the Jacobins in this weird way by being so militantly anti-royalist. He's saying like, hey, you guys don't have to worry about, but also why the hell would an emperor replace himself with a king, you know? So I don't know if I buy that 100%, but also if the Jacobins were worried about Napoleon just being a placeholder until there's a Bourbon restoration, until a royalist restoration, then if he were to do something this extreme, they'd be like, oh, maybe he's.
I mean, the royalists.
Our side, you know?
The royalists exist. Like,
yeah.
They're trying to push for that. Like, it's. I see Napoleon always doing Machiavellian things.
Yeah.
He doesn't really care.
For sure.
This is more about increasing his own power base.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's like he saw a lot of horror in the French Revolution. Like mm-hmm. He actually saw it. And again, you go back to that garden in Big Dog. He just wants to re-implement the basics of the French mm-hmm. garden, which is like, yeah, we had an aristocracy before. Let's create an mm-hmm. aristocracy out of these generals. And also we had a fucking Christianity before. Let's go mm-hmm. back to the Catholic Church and let's have
get that graft.
Let's graft that shit in. And we're going to mm-hmm. recreate the garden with mm-hmm. also we've grafted in the liberté, égalité, fraternité mm-hmm. all into that. And it's going to be a good thing. And I can do it because I'm Napoleon and I have a massive fucking ego.
Yep. Like, and no more weeds. No weeds. No weeds. Can't tolerate them. I'm sorry.
And some people, it doesn't matter how young they are, they're weeds in my opinion. Weeds. They get pulled.
May 3rd of 1804, Tribunate votes that Napoleon is named emperor, and he had the ability to name his own successor. So we went 12-5-3-1. Finally, Napoleon, Emperor Napoleon on top, big dog status. No one else is fucking with him. Joseph, his younger brother Joseph, is named his immediate successor, followed by his other brother Louis. He eventually named Josephine the Empress. She's crowned on December 2nd, 1804, and by Pope Pius the 8th. It's messy with Josephine.
Yeah, Josephine's. It's like part of the deal with Josephine is that with the church coming in, is them talking about like, yo, I can divorce her, right? If like that still being like kind of a thing that they're all right, because you know Josephine isn't gonna have kids, and they're like, and he needs a successor, to make this valid. So,
but Pope Pius is like, you kind of know how we feel about divorce. We're not really.
Yeah, but we're going to square this one away. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. We're getting thorny with it. But Napoleon's also like, are you really going to oppose me on this.
Yeah.
And both sides are kind of just like, eh, we'll talk about it later. You know, we'll do it. We'll do this right now, but I don't know.
I mean, and yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
And Napoleon is keeping like several mistresses at this time. It should be mentioned. And I think they both are. I'm not so sure about Josephine. I know, like we mentioned last episode, her and Hippolyte Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many other. Is a male mistress still a mistress?
I don't.
Is a male side piece still a mist? No, they have to a mister, I guess.
I don't know. I don't know.
Would be the equivalent.
I don't. I don't know. All I know about Josephine is that like, she, when it's she's been dreading like the day when he like becomes the emperor.
Yeah.
Not because one. She sees that everybody around him is like pushing him to power, but also she knows that like she knows that he needs a heir at this point. And this is the part of the disintegration of their relationship.
But really. He loves her.
He does love her. But he loves her. It is very true. He does love her. Now, does he love her more than he wants to be emperor? No.
And he loves himself?
Yeah, no.
I don't know.
Nope, not at all.
Could he even? Yeah, he clearly.
Not at all.
We'll talk about it. Yeah, we'll get there. The Pope is also present at Napoleon's coronation at Notre Dame. He also leveraged the Pope to name a new saint. It was a Roman martyr, also named Napoleon. And the feast day was on Napoleon's birthday, that being August 15th.
Yeah.
You know, big dog status. Just you're going to name a new saint, Saint Napoleon. His feast day is on my birthday. Kill two birds with one stone right there.
I imagine, though, that it's somewhat like the way that Houston has gives away days. Like, everybody in Houston has a day. So I just imagine the Pope was just like, yeah, man, can have a... we can name them. We can do that all the time, Big Dub. We do that all the time for everybody. You want to feel special? It's okay.
You get a day. You know, everybody gets a day here.
Well, the city of Houston is handing out days and saying, it's your day. Like, I've never seen.
How do I get in on this? Can I have a day?
Just go down to the courthouse. Like, it's literally just go down to the courthouse. Okay, you can get a day.
Really? What? I can get a Henry Price?
Yeah. You can make it a day. Yeah.
All right. Now, does it have to be like, because my birthday is May 29th and it's already on Memorial Henry, Day.
I don't know the specifics.
So I'm just thinking ahead. Like, I would either like preempt Memorial Day or I wouldn't try to eclipse it. I would try to like extend it to like hitch my star to Memorial Day. You know what I mean?
Now,
like, you want a 2-day celebration, right? You want 2 days off. You can have Henry Price Day and Memorial Day. As long as on Henry Price Day, you read a fucking book, you stupid son of a bitch.
I feel like I have to now explain to you that if you get a day in Houston, it's still not like a federal holiday.
No.
And nobody gets it off. It's just
Hey man, what do you think hashtags are for? Okay.
You just get a plaque. That's all you get, a plaque.
Damn,
you just get a
right.
plaque. Yeah.
Never mind. I was assuming other people would give a shit. I guess my mistake.
No, like, people don't give a shit about Napoleon's birthday and the martyr saint of fucking, nobody cares. It's the same shit. Like,
everybody's just looking for a day off, man. When it comes down to it, everybody's at least.
It doesn't give you a day off. It's just so you can have a plaque that says, this is my day. And that's cool.
Yeah,
but like, it's still, you know what? It's a pet peeve.
Okay. I don't know. December of 1804, Spain enters the war, I think, against Great Britain. They join the side of the French for now. The French ships are bottled up in Toulon, Brest, Ferrol, and Rochefort. And Napoleon wants his top admiral, Villeneuve, to break out of Toulon, which is in the southern France. He link up with the Spanish and then sail to Boulogne on the northern side of France to escort this invasion fleet to Great Britain, because that's another thing, they were planning an invasion of Great Britain.
Yeah, it's a Great Britain, not Catholic.
Yes,
France and Spain, hella Catholic.
Yes,
and linked up with Rome.
Yep,
and you know, the British have a problem with the Catholics.
Yep.
As detailed in Irish history.
Yeah.
Like, so, yeah.
And all the Catholics are like, let's get it, you know?
When the Catholics are not, they don't have a great history. It's a whole thing. Yeah.
1805, in the meantime, Napoleon crowns himself king of Italy in Milan. Austria resumes war against him, primarily due to that. So they kick things back up again. Mm-hmm. Villeneuve breaks the blockade and ends up in Cadiz, which is like southern Spain. It's a port on the south of Spain. The combined Spanish and French fleet are bottled up there and basically kept in check by the British Navy. Napoleon is not happy with Villeneuve. They have a falling out. He's kind of like raging. August of 1805, Austria joins the Third Coalition with William Pitt of Great Britain and Tsar Alexander I of Russia. The Russia's whole deal was that Great Britain gets hemp and lumber from the Baltics, which were under the control of Russia at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Russia also wants a foothold in the Mediterranean. Again, Austria resents Napoleon's meddling in Italy, as well as his assertion of what they view as a bogus aristocracy. Because you think about it, you have all these old world Austrians who are used to the hoity-toity aristocratic nature of their society and time for, what, a couple centuries at least. And here you have just all these kind of swarthy generals and, you know, rapists and looters in their eyes. Now, these are the aristocrats. These are the ones who run the estate. We don't think so. Their goal is to push out France from Switzerland, Italy, Hanover, Holland, and Northern Germany.
Yeah, people don't understand. Like, you can just make an aristocracy. I didn't realize. I've been reading more, and this happens, of course, in Napoleon and in Irish history, that the Protestant ascendancy is just like they just gave niggas land.
Yeah.
And told them, like, yo, you're now. And over a series of like 100 years,
yeah.
If you start acting like that's the same thing happens in Virginia in America, like if you start acting like aristocracy, people just kind of can treat you like aristocracy after a while.
There's nothing inherent to an aristocrat, you know. You inherit as an aristocrat, but there's no distinguishing mark, really. You can be an aristocrat as long as you got land and money and maybe manners.
It doesn't matter how you get it. It's always it's usually always from some type of like blood lust or trickery.
Yes,
like or you just was killing the Lenin game.
Mm-hmm.
you was murdering 1807 Lenin.
You're either inheriting blood or you're spilling blood.
Yeah,
or you're just an opportunist.
You are right time, right place, and you really understand the Lenin market.
Hey man, that's all you do. That's all you have to do. So on September 26th of 1805, Napoleon arrives at Strasbourg, basically on the modern French-German border now, to meet his grand army. It's 210,000 men to the Danube ASAP. He gets them there because he's having to fight. I think Austria is the first. His first target in this new emerging coalition.
Mm-hmm.
So on October 21st of 1805, you have the Battle of Trafalgar, which is again like right near Gibraltar in southern Spain. Villeneuve engages the British Navy rather than be dismissed because Napoleon had sent papers ordering his resignation. I think Villeneuve like knew they were coming, and he would just rather roll the dice. I guess it was he really shat the bed, but also I kind of get it. If you're just like, well, somebody fucked up. That's what I know. I'm not sure who, somebody fucked up.
It's weird when you read a lot of like older, like what am I saying? Older history, a lot of history in general, generals are like when it becomes wartime, they're not like really like controllable figures.
they kind of
do whatever the fuck they want to do, and then like there's a military kind of hierarchy to rein them in with like France and stuff, like with what it seems like with Napoleon is that there is no military hierarchy. It's just all kind of egos competing, and Napoleon's the biggest dick in the bunch, and that's kind of it. And they just yeah, you can send orders that way.
Yeah.
But if that nigga's going to follow him, that's another question.
Yeah, man, that's a whole nother thing. And you know, that's where, especially older, because I don't know if you can make the same argument for like the United States, because, you know, the Patton. Fucking contrarian Patton. In me wanted me to be like, oh, well, isn't this the same thing? And it's like, no, I feel like there's some kind of new stability. Either we're removed from time from this kind of mindset. You know, like maybe in the older days, maybe in World War II, you saw some of this like big dick swinging generals just kind of free balling, doing whatever they felt like. But especially like early 19th century and way before, very decentralized. It's just like, I'm going to do what I think is best. And like, maybe I lick the boot of the guy who's giving me orders. If he does happen to have a bigger boot than I do, or maybe I spit in his face, I do what I think is right. I take a risk. I engage the enemy. I capture their chief general. And all of a sudden I've got the biggest dick on the schoolyard, you know?
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I would just argue it's that fucking hierarchy where they, now it's communication. Now they can all be like, the nigga can actually just call and be like, oh,
yeah, that's a good point.
And then now I see, that your second in command sees you're disobeying an order, and he'd be like, okay, well, now and then
you can just get on a Zoom call with him and be like, hey, dude, what the fuck?
You're relieved of command. Like, but nah, there's a bunch of ego, you know, Stormer Norman Schwarzkopf. Yeah. Like, why do I know that nigga's name?
Because he was storming, man.
Because that 6 day war that they fought, mm-hmm. that was storming. That 2 week war in 1991. Never mind. All right.
Trafalgar is a huge victory for Great Britain. The French and Spanish fleet, I think, for the most part, is like entirely wiped out. And Napoleon predictably does not take that news great, as he's trying to fight Austria because now he's having to basically compensate for Villeneuve's defeat. He's trying to corner the enemy in Vienna. The Austrian general Kutuzov doesn't fall for the tactics that he's using, he's trying to keep them in Vienna and then siege Vienna. Kutuzov doesn't fall for it. He bails. And so November 20th, 1805, Napoleon is in Brunn. We're talking like Western Czechia, I think. He's negotiating, stalling for time. He invaded West Germany and Prussia to quickly reach Vienna and then check the Austrians. Emperor Alexander positions his Russian forces at Olmütz in an attempt to cut off Napoleon's access to Vienna because the French had invested there. So on December 2nd, 1805, as a result of all that maneuvering, you have the Battle of Austerlitz. Napoleon, he wants to halt the Russian and Austrian retreat, so his supply and communication lines aren't stretched too thin. He doesn't want to chase them further east. He splits his army and positions it well. He like feigns weakness at some point. I'm not sure which battle it is. It might have been this one where he like, there's like some hill that he allows the enemy to capture by like gradually luring them over. And then he has an investment of troops on the other side of that hill. So by the time the enemy takes the high ground and has what they perceive of as this advantage, he just rushes them in their entirety before they're able to set up and overwhelms them. It's 26,000 Austrian and Russian casualties to only about 9,000 French. So Austria sues for peace, and there's, you know, territorial concessions that are granted as a result. And he has neutralized this threat for now. This gets us into Act 3, the hurricane. March 31st of 1806, Napoleon names his brother Joseph king of Naples by imperial decree. There are other dynastic marriages because he had, I think, like 11 brothers and sisters. He was like one of 11. And so he's got, quote unquote, royal stock to bargain with. He's got some bargaining, some pretty sweet bargaining chips that he's able to use to consolidate his hold over Europe.
Yeah, it comes from a firm crop, mm-hmm. a good mm-hmm. harvest of children.
Prolific.
Prolific. Yep.
The Confederation of the Rhine is created in Germany. They acknowledge Napoleon as or Napoleon and the French and France specifically as its protector. They promised to raise 63,000 troops for him and station their army of 170,000 in South Germany, ready for mobilization where needed. You know, brief reminder that being in South Germany, if they're ready for mobilization, that would most likely be against the Austrians immediately. So it's this check against Austria.
It's also the South Germany, or South, if I'm correct on this, South Germany is the more conservative and I think the more like Catholic part of the region, from my understanding.
I'm not sure about that.
You can quote me on it. Okay, don't quote me on it though. All right. Don't quote me on it. Okay, that's fine.
So the creation of the Confederation of the Rhine, it upsets Prussia because it further divides up, and Prussia is modern East Germany. It's like the biggest.
Then the Confederation of the Rhine is, it involves Cologne, and Cologne is like notorious, is Catholic. That's Catholic.
Okay, Germany. Right on. Cool.
So yes. Okay. Yes. You got this
Catholic axis coming together.
Yeah.
Prussia's upset because the creation of the Confederation of the Rhine divides up their territory. It was also leaked that the emperor was willing to turn over Hanover, which is this like city state in modern northwestern Germany. Napoleon was willing to turn that over to the British, and Prussia finds out about it. They had only recently acquired Hanover, and so they're upset about that as well. It's demanded by Prussia that they blockade Great Britain as well, and as a result, Britain impresses 700 German ships, and so Prussia has reason to be upset at the French and at the British, but they're more upset at Napoleon than they are at the British. So they start their own uprising. September 24th of 1806 is when Napoleon crosses into Germany to fight the Prussians. And the decisive battle there, October of 1806, you have the Battle of Jena, I think. J-E-N-A, Jena, 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 and Auerstadt. The French general de Voot in the latter battle, Auerstadt, is way more impressive. He like defeats the main army, 26,000 to 60,000 Prussians under the Duke of Brunswick. And de Voot pulls off a victory, even though he's got less than half of the men that the Duke of Brunswick does. The combined French army, they enter Berlin with about 120,000 prisoners of war. Germany agrees, I should say Prussia specifically, they agree to reparations and basically become a French vassal.
It's really hard to not say Germany, because we do have this, we have kind of think of these things as eternal, but the Germany doesn't exist yet.
Not yet.
Another 60 years?
Neither does Italy, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Germany another 60, Italy sometime around 50, 60 years from now, from that, from the dates we're talking about, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of a through line through this, more specifically in the next episode, but also you see it a little bit here with the creation of like the Confederation of the Rhine. Mm-hmm. And I think with the Cisalpine Republic in Italy, but particularly in the German case, I want to talk about, because a part of like early German nationalism, even before like the 1860s, is birthed in this time as a reaction to Napoleon.
Yeah.
They're all kind of saying like, hey, we might have some different religious ideas and social ideas, but we all for the most part speak the same language and we don't like this guy. So let's figure out what else we have in common here.
I think the Napoleon and Napoleonic Wars are like responsible for a lot of the creation of modern Europe. Yes. I would say, pre-World War II or World War, I don't know about that. But like you can look at, again, I'm reading that book on Ireland, and they talk a lot about like the beginning of the potato famine. This guy, the guy in the book, is trying to break down that it really is about like the end of the Napoleonic Wars and this shifting, like, and so it's like some shift that happens in the economy of like Great Britain or something that happens with the end of Napoleon or in the Napoleonic era, to where they start to import from Ireland more cattle products or cattle and products of cows. So they go from a subsistence farming, tenant farming like type of economy. And then it becomes this whole thing about now these are becoming pastures for grazing.
Yeah.
And now there's not as much food because the farmers, the tenants are getting kicked off for the grazing.
Yeah.
And there's a whole buildup of, and that starts with the end of the Napoleonic era. Mm. So it's a lot. It's a lot. And that, yeah.
You never know what dominoes will be toppled.
Yeah.
November of 1806, after what we would think of as Germany, after Prussia, Germany generally, Prussia specifically, is pacified, is conquered. That opens the door to Poland. So Napoleon and the French march into Poland. They're initially pursuing, the pretext for this march is they're pursuing Queen Louise of Germany. And she was like this, basically like an Amazonian warrior woman who she's got like a following of her own, and she's not surrendered, and she's got her own forces that are loyal to her. She eventually does surrender, but they're pursuing Queen Louise, and they also just wanted more territory generally, because that seems to be the way things are going. And he's like feigning toward Polish independence because they were long basically ping-ponged between the Prussians and the Russians, and they kind of want autonomy, understandably.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Very reasonable. Morale for the French army is at an all-time low. They're like marching through the mud of Poland, and army desertions are around 40% for that year. Napoleon he's trying to recruit from Denmark and Holland, and he's enforcing these forced loans on Germany in order to pay for the army that remained. February 7th of 1807, you have the Battle of Eylau, and it's framed as a French victory, but it was a rough one. The French just kind of barely scraped by. You've got 25,000 dead to 15,000 Russians, because the Russians are still fighting, and that's another reason why he was marching into Poland, is to pursue the Russians. The Russians, under their general Bennigsen, they leave the field, and so that's why it's framed as a French victory. There's a big painting in the Louvre of Napoleon at Eylau, and it's again framed as he's this benevolent conqueror king who's like visiting the wounded and sick of the enemy. But it's pretty gnarly. I'll post it.
Yeah. I mean, Polish independence, Polish nationalism is directly tied to Napoleon, because he's the first one to kind of, I don't know if he's the first, but he kind of champions their a lot of things in Poland are they like Napoleon, from my understanding. I don't know that much about it. Also, it's very weird to me, after this, once Poland becomes a nation, then we're gonna have those pogroms in Poland. And I want to know what that's about. I don't know what Poland's up to, because there's a lot of pogroms, and that's like one of the push reasons for a lot of immigration of Jewish people.
I think they're also like very anti-abortion as well.
Because it's Catholic, from my understanding, and that's probably also why. Would you start reading the history of Europe, and then you just be like, some of this is just about y'all being Catholic and other people being Protestant, and that's like,
yep.
That's where the alliance is kind of tied down to.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's really just different aristocracies fighting each other. It's like, oh.
It seems to me like they were all these different various European nations and provinces before they were even nations and city-states or whatever. They were all fighting each other before.
Yeah.
And then came the Protestant Catholic schism Reformation. Then they were like, oh, now we have a reason. Now we have a real reason for all this stuff. Now, you know, they were just like, hell yeah, we've been looking for a vehicle for this hatred, and now we've got a solid one, you know.
Yeah, I hate to do this right now, but I'm gonna do something that's so on brand for me. This is a lot like Bloods and Crips. There were gangs before Bloods and Crips, and they were fighting. And then they just threw on this like the tassels of being, oh, you're a blood, I'm a Crip, and then that's, you know, that's why
it all fell into place.
It all falls into place, and then there's a development of weaponry.
Yeah,
and then all of a sudden that shit becomes very dangerous.
You have a framework. You have a framework for the bloodshed, and now it all occurs within this lens. And you know, bloodshed is deplorable, sure, but at least people can agree on the framework. You know,
Protestants are Crips, and that's what I want to say.
I would say Catholics are Crips, because they're the ones with the crypts, with the literal crypts, you know, with all the skulls in the tombs. You can go out. I feel like Professor Fink from With the Skulls in the Tombs. Ahoy, you know,
swing and a miss.
April to June of 1807, Napoleon is at Schloss Finkenstein with Maria Waluska, who is his Polish mistress. Mm-hmm. He's licking his wounds, telling Josephine not to come because he's with his Polish mistress, and he's preparing for a resumed Russian campaign because Russia's still in it.
His Polish mistress also younger. Josephine's older than him. Maria is younger than Napoleon, also has the ability to have a child. Yep. And Napoleon, you know, doesn't treat women correctly and doesn't value them. He only values what they can do for him. So mm-hmm. We'll see how that plays out.
Yeah. I don't think I mention it in either of these episodes, but he does, Maria Waluska does bear him a son at some point. And that's how he knows that Josephine is barren, that he's like, it's not me.
Yeah.
And I imagine Josephine's probably like, but how do you know it's not you? And
he's Joseph,
like, ah.
Josephine, yeah, no, that's, yeah. She becomes the empress, and Josephine ends up, we'll probably get to it at some point later, but ends up, you know, fairly well off, but
very well off. Yeah.
But like, you know, he pays her like a little stipend, like she gets it. This is recurring, but like,
yeah,
she still is writing a lot of love letters to this nigga and thinking about him. And they're not together.
It's an interesting I think there's a whole book that's been written on like their relationship exclusively, which would be a great read.
That was what my book Scar, Napoleon, a life in Gardens, it covers their relationship a lot, but also a lot of these gardeners are a lot of like people putting together houses, design stuff. It's interesting.
So by May of 1807, the French Grand Army forces at around 600,000, including those guarding France, Holland, Naples, and Dalmatia in, I think that's the Balkans, Dalmatia. Anyway, he raises about 100,000 German soldiers to prevent an uprising, and he places them under guys that he trusts, obviously. June 14th, 1807, you have the Battle of Friedland. Bennigsen positions his army with its back to the river. Napoleon seizes the advantage. And then by June 25th of 1807, because of this sweeping French victory at Friedland, Tsar Alexander I and Napoleon meet on a barge on the river Tislet.
Oh, no one on that. I got no idea on that one, big dog.
I was gonna call, okay, right on. That's all good.
You're good. You guess as good as mine.
Thanks, man. And they're real friendly. Supposedly, like, there have been, or there's like, from what I read about their meeting, is they were like bros, they were regular old chums, they were contemporaries of their time meeting each other. I think Napoleon even says something weird, something along the lines of like, yeah, if he were a woman, I would fuck him, or something. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but it's something to that effect of like, if he was a woman, we'd get it on, you know. Very weird.
Yeah, stuff. No, I mean, no. there's a lot of homoerotic behavior going on, and also at the same time, I think about it this way: it wasn't a whole lot of people who could write and read, and then you could get letters to niggas. You could just get a letter to somebody quick, and like they had. Because even him as a young person, he's like interacting with like Paolo Pasquale, who's like the national hero of like of their like whatever. Corsica. Yeah, of course, Corsican independence. He's like, why the fuck do you have access to this dude? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How the fuck can you just be like,
yeah?
Like, but I guess
simpler times.
Yeah, I guess, or I don't know, man. But two bros, when they get together, they just like to bro down.
Yeah, man.
Like, bro down.
Carve up Europe. No big deal.
Come on.
Just another day, you know?
Another day in the life. I'm supposed to TikTok about this.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
That would be a good one. But they, like, see each other in each other. You know, they're both European rulers on top of their game. I mean, Tsar Alexander, he's got to be a little more bent of the knee, so to speak, because here he is, Napoleon, you know, the big N, right?
Well, yeah, Napoleon seen as this like weird self-made man.
Yeah, because he is.
I would argue he's a little bit, dude, he is self-made, but I would argue a lot. It's a lot more of the flukes of history.
Yeah, man.
Just being in the right place at the right time, big dog. That's a lot of being self-made. Yeah. Just being right there and like, be all right, but I'll do it though.
For sure. For sure. It's like, I don't know. I think, or just with all the history that we've studied generally,
mm-hmm.
I get increasingly the sense that it's just like, oh, this is just like one big accident.
Yeah, it feels like that. It'd be like, damn, this is one big accident. But then you just, once you start believing, hold on, it's a lot. Like we,
you know what I mean?
It's a lot. It's a lot. Yeah.
Not always, but
no.
For the most part, it's just like shit just is just happening and people are just doing things and thrust into situations where it's just like, oh shit, you know.
This is one of those like weird hustle videos, YouTube, Instagram, reels, hustle, you know what I mean? Where it's niggas, somebody talking to a business owner. It was just some dude from New York, I guess, who had like a lot of some money or something. And they were just like, yeah, best advice I can give you, don't make plans, make moves. And that's what history feels like. Nobody's making any plans. They have a plan, but then they just start making moves.
Just kind of doing shit, yeah.
And then after a while, you kind of end up, you know, it either works or it doesn't.
Closing out, July 7th of 1807, the treaty between the Russians and the French is ratified. The Russians agreed to join the blockade against Great Britain. Germany's carved up some more. Napoleon names Jerome as king of Westphalia, which is a German, I think, like state equivalency, if you want to think, or a German mm-hmm. province, Westphalia. There's a joint Franco-Russian venture against Great Britain in India. I think they just plan it. It never actually gets off the ground, but they're at least like, all right, we're hitting India. You know, it's time. Another stipulation, Alexander won't intervene if Napoleon invades the Iberian Peninsula, which we'll talk about next episode. Napoleon will mediate if Alexander invades Turkey, where the Ottomans are still sitting fairly comfortably. Mm-hmm. Alexander will mediate in a Franco-British war mediation, and the Duchy of Warsaw is to oversee Poland, and French troops would be stationed in Prussia. Napoleon gets back to Paris. He is now struggling with whether or not to divorce Josephine because he wants an heir and she is barren. And there's all these talks that he's having with, I think particularly with Talleyrand, but other advisors where they're saying that would be best for his own hold on power, and what would be best for France is if they had some kind of inter-European marriage. Like another princess of some sort. Mm-hmm. Talleyrand, he's in with the Austrians and he's advocating for Napoleon to marry an Austrian princess because Talleyrand is being paid by the Austrian. And Fouché, who at this time, I think throughout Fouché's like, he was framed in one of these books as the J. Edgar Hoover of his time because he was in charge of like the French secret police and he had tabs on everybody. And Fouché talks to Josephine about the rumor of divorce that is hanging over them. And she explains that she is worried that if Napoleon divorced her, he would lose his good luck. He would basically be thrown off of his winning streak because Napoleon, in some of his letters, and I think it was like something that they cultivated between them, like an ongoing thing where Napoleon had frequently referred to Josephine as like his good luck charm and that she would bring luck to him in battle, and Josephine herself kind of fed that narrative and they built a thing out of it. And Josephine saying to Fouché, if he divorces me, he's not going to do well in battle anymore. So we'll see what fate has in store for Napoleon if he does decide to divorce Josephine. Will it impact his ability to to compete in the European theater, or is this all just one big silly superstitious remonstrance? We shall see.
We'll see, but we all know the answer. He was in battle before he met Josephine. So, like, I don't... And he's been hella lucky his whole life in terms of, like... But we'll see. All right.
But things got a hell of a lot better. After they got married, he was on an upswing, you know, and she's a good luck charm. And he did well, I guess not in Egypt. She didn't work in Egypt.
Yeah, in Egypt.
I'll say that.
Yeah.
Not in Egypt, but... Everywhere else.
I mean, he did duck an assassination in Egypt that was coming for his head.
Okay, so there you go. So, you know?
All right. Well, we'll see you on the next episode of Hard Fried History. Thank you guys for listening to this episode. This has been part two of the part three of the three-parter on Napoleon of our six-parter on the French Revolution and the Napoleonic era. Thank you guys for listening. You can follow us at Hard for History on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. You can find me at Joshua B. Stokes on Instagram and Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, all this other stuff. Henry, where can they follow you?
You can find me, Henry Price, on Instagram, Henry Price on Facebook. Follow the business at Blush Daisy and follow me on Amazon at Henry Price : Hard Fried History. Give them hot reviews.
It's a good time. We love you. We'll see you next time. Okay. All right. Love you.
Be safe. Wear your mask, damn it.
Still out here doing it. All right. See you later, big dog. Peace. Take care.